The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, the Rapa Nui peoples of Easter Island have sculpted statues known as moai for centuries. These statues are likely familiar to you. Giant stone heads with prominent, figurative, facial features. We will learn all about how the moai statues were transported by the Rapa Nui on the island to their places of display. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. On Easter Island, off the coast of Chile in South America, there is a stone quarry that was once a volcano. The Rapa Nui used the volcanic material to make their famous Easter Island statues, the moai. The moai are huge, and they are known around the world for their elongated heads and stoic expressions. They were made by the Rapa Nui to honor their ancestors. Have you ever wondered how the moai were transferred from where they were created to where they are displayed? Well, surprisingly, they walked. At least that is what the Rapa Nui say and said to European colonizers. Even though the statues don't have legs and are, well, statues. From the quarry, the Rapa Nui used a method of transportation that made the moai appear as if they were walking. I spoke with Carl Lippo, a professor of anthropology at Binghamton University, to learn more.
Yeah, moai are large monumental statues carved by people who lived on Rapa Nui in the past, prior to European arrival in 1722. They're staggeringly large. It's really hard to convey the magnitude of these things because you see photos of them and you can imagine statues, you know, people size or double people size, but they range from several meters tall to nearly 10 meters tall. That's 30 feet tall, which is the size of a three-story building. So if you imagine a stone statue three stories tall, you get a better picture of what the magnitude of these figures. They're carved from a stone that comes from a particular quarry. Well, most of them carved from a particular quarry called Ranuraku, which is a volcanic crater located in sort of the southeast corner of the island. It's made out of a compressed volcanic ash, a tuff, which formed from a volcano that erupted long before people got there. The ash settled around the crater and then got compressed over time and became the source of where the statues are carved from. It's not a particularly hard rock. If you can imagine it more like a sandstone, if you've sort of touched a sandstone. So it's not, you know, people carved these things with other stone tools made of slightly harder material. So it is an inconceivably hard material, but it's done on such a magnitude and scale that it's really an impressive feat for carving them. The challenge, of course, is carving them is one thing, which took, you know, a lot of time, but then they had to move them from the quarry to the places that they wanted to bring them to, which are platforms called ahu, which are located all around the island, a lot of them along the coast, but some in the inland.
So you kind of talked about the Rapa Nui peoples. Before we really get into the nitty-gritty of your research, I kind of wanted to ask a little bit about them. So, you know, why did they create these moai statues? What was their culture like in those times as well?
That's a great question. One of the challenges, of course, we don't specifically know. The Rapa Nui people still live on the island today. And if you go to the island and visit it, you'll talk to Rapa Nui people, the descendants of people who carved the statues. Culture was deeply impacted by the arrival of Europeans through disease and all kinds of other terrible things. There are oral traditions that connect with the statues, but it's sort of piecemeal because there's a lot of information lost. And unfortunately, a lot of the Europeans that were there early on didn't really ask enough questions that record these things down. So there's a lot of this sort of piecing things together. But we do know a number of things. We do know that the statues, and this is because we see this elsewhere across Polynesia, the statues represent ancestors, that they're carved and placed in areas of honor as ancestors that look on the community and sort of look over the community's future and its well-being. This is a tradition that actually we see elsewhere in Polynesia. They take different forms in East Polynesia. We see them as tiki in, say, Hawaii and the Tahiti. They're often made of wood, but they're also stone versions of these that we find some of the islands in Hawaii, in the Austral Islands, etc. So it's a Polynesian tradition. So it's part of the Polynesian culture that Rapa Nui people brought to the island because they're descendants of other Polynesians. So it's definitely related to ancestor honorific. It's possible each of them have names. So if you talk to people today, they'll know the names of each of them. So it's thought that they potentially represent particular ancestors, you know, so that to honor a particular person. But we don't quite know because it's a bit of lost information. But they do have names. They're not all the same carved. I mean, you'll see photos of the images of them, and they have a lot of similarities in terms of the shape of the face and the mouth and the ears, but each one is slightly different from each other. So there's some personality to them, which reflects either the carving artistry or the individuals that they're trying to represent.
So you have spent a long time researching the Moai and the Easter Island, and you've even co-written a book. So, you know, this new research, what was that specifically about, and how did you conduct your study on it?
Well, this research goes back a long ways. We initially avoided wanting to look at transport of the statues themselves. You know, we were really interested in understanding all the other things that go into statue construction. In other words, there's a lot of speculation and a lot of stories about statue, how they're moving, the technology there. But we thought, well, let's just focus on the community. What was the community doing? Like, what are they doing around the statues? Like, what are they eating? Where are they eating? Where are they growing food? What's the industry, sort of the tools that they're creating in order their survival, their cooking practices, etc. Because we really understand sort of the Moai in the context of the community, because it's clearly a community effort. You can't make one by yourself, right? You need other people to do it. So the community has to be embedded in that community structure. But as we were doing the surveys that we were doing to understand that, we kept encountering statues, and we started noting that, well, the statues that we find that aren't at the quarry and aren't at the platforms where they ended up, often have a lot of features that were very distinctive. And we found that these statues that were in between the quarry and their platforms had very different features than those locations, and that those features might be telling us about transport. So we sort of stumbled into this idea, this observation that the statues themselves have information about the transport. One of our colleagues, Sergio Rapu, actually said something interesting to us that really triggered us to sort of rethink how we were imagining the study of statue transport. He said, which is true, the Rapa Nui carvers were incredibly talented, which you can really see. They can carve amazing things, you know, these giant figures. They could carve anything they wanted to. They could have carved things with tails and wings and hats and all kinds of stuff. But they had to get it from point A to point B. They had to carve them in such a way to transport them from the place that they started to the place they ended up. You know, whatever they were doing, especially in the ones that were in between, were telling us about the decisions that people made to get them from the quarry to the platforms. So as we started doing that, we started thinking, well, what are these features telling us? What we saw was the statues had an immense forward lean. This was sort of a really interesting challenge. Statues at the platform stand upright because they're meant to be standing there looking at the community. The statues, though, before they get to the platform, were leaning forward in such a way that they wouldn't stand up on their own. And it doesn't make sense. Why would you carve something that couldn't stand up if your goal is to get it to a place to have it stand up, right? So it really puzzled us. Like, well, why would you do that? Like, why is this thing leaning forward and it would fall over? That led us into this understanding, well, maybe this is tied to transport. We started systematically looking at all the features that might be related to transport, and you know, with the idea of like, what is this telling us? And through the observations of the way they're broken on the landscape, the way they fell, the fracturing patterns, and this forward lean, and other shape factors, we realized that the only way they could have gotten to that state as we see them across the landscape is that they fell from a standing position, and that upright transport was part of getting them from point A to point B. Now, this isn't, in one way, it's sort of wild. Like, why would anyone move a gigantic three-story stone thing in a standing position? And you know, and many people have said, that's impossible. You could never do it. But in fact, we do it all the time. You know, if we're moving a refrigerator from one side of the kitchen to the other, you don't lay it on its back and then shuffle it on wheels over. You know, you rock it and shuffle it. You can shovel, you know, a 600-pound refrigerator across your kitchen, you know, sort of in this standing position. That's exactly what it looks like. Statues that people were moving Moai were doing. The difference is that they carved them in such a way to maximize the ability to do that. That they use that the standing position as a sort of engine to get it moving from place to place. So as we started studying the statues, sort of we came to this conclusion that we only way we could explain what we were seeing was through this mode of transport. We wrote a book. That's actually the story of the book we wrote called The Statues That Walk, just sort of how we came to that conclusion. It was something that we didn't seek out to figure out. It was something we were like, well, this is the only way we can account for that based on the evidence that we had. Really, it's about doing the archaeology and the details. And the statue, I should mention also that the idea of them moving in a standing position isn't really radical from a Rapa Nui perspective. If you look at back at some of the when Europeans did ask Rapa Nui people, how did the statues get moved? They said pretty consistently, they walked, right? They like, well, they walked from point A to point B. And of course, Europeans were like, oh, that's hilarious. Sure they walked with air quotes around the walking. How did they really move them? And so people, Europeans sort of ignored that as an explanation, but it's clearly embedded in the stories that they said. And they don't say they flew, they didn't say they rolled, they said they walked over and over again. So it's like, oh, this is interesting that they were saying this, and the archaeological evidence points to that. So it isn't as radical as you might think. So we did back in 2012, we did a Nova special where they asked us, well, that's a great idea. Like, can you actually do it? And we initially said, like, well, we could try, but we're not good at. We might be able to explain how they moved, they walked, but like moving them is a whole nother set of knowledge that we don't have. But they're like, no, you got to show it. So they did that. So that's one of the things that we did back then, and which is often shows up in YouTube videos of us walking the statue, which was an amazing experience. I can tell you, it was a stunning experience. This recent, so that sort of for us sort of locked in, like, okay, this is a really plausible thing. When you see that thing moving, you're like, well, that's a good way to move a statue. This recent paper that came out just this November was really sort of looking back at the physics of that model. Because we'd sort of explained the archaeological record, we had demonstrated how it was feasible, but we really wanted to understand is does the physics match what we experienced when we tried to move it? And what's the force required in order to get it rocking? Is it feasible with the resources that they had and the people they had to get it rocking, to pull it from side to side, even the biggest ones? Is it feasible? Is the rate at which we were able to walk it? Because we were able to walk ours in about 100 meters in 30, 40 minutes, I think is what we did. Pretty fast, right? And so did the speed that we were doing it match this physics expectation? Does the physics work? Because ultimately it's a physical problem. You got to get a giant thing from point A to point B, and in the absence of cranes and magic, you're going to use the physics to make that happen. So the paper was really focusing on that aspect, and what we found, which is really rewarding, was like, indeed, the physics does match. And it's, of course, it's not terribly surprising because we did do it, and physics worked when we tried it. The rate at which we were able to walk it matches really well. All the physics in terms of the number of people required to move it matches perfectly well. All the things that we experienced are real true, and it scales because that was the important thing. Often people said, "Well, your statue was only 10 feet tall. 10 feet tall—that's a teeny tiny statue." Even though it was incredibly heavy, like you couldn't shake it. If you pushed it, it didn't go anywhere. But yeah, it's a small statue relative to the gargantuan's one. So the question is, could we move a gigantic one that was 30 feet tall? And the fact is yes, because in fact, as the statues get taller, the physics begins to it scales. Like it's taller, which means you have more leverage, which means it's easier to rock it from side to side. It doesn't take orders of magnitude more people. You just it's sort of a it's an additive problem. So rather than I think we did ours with 15 people, you could probably move some of the largest one with 40 people. It really isn't a gigantic number of people, perfectly within the scale of resources and people that they had on the island.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. If you're just joining us, we're learning all about the Moai statues on Easter Island and how they were transported. with Carl Lippo, a professor of anthropology at Binghamton University, to learn more.
So you talked about, which one of my questions kind of covers, that the experience of walking the statue was like a stunning experience. And I wanted to ask you about that. What was that like being there? And I mean, you've also, it seems like, been to Easter Island. What was that like seeing the statues in person as well?
Start with the statues in person first, that one, because that sort of set it all up. As I said, it's really hard to sort of grasp the magnitude and scope of these things, the scale of these statues. You know, there's 1,000 statues on the island, 400 still in the quarry where they're in the process of being carved, which you can see all the technology and the different experiments and things we're trying as people seeing there. So you can really see a lot of evidence of the manufacturing side. But then there's 600 that have been moved outside of the quarry, all in various states of disrepair, brokenness, but many in the Ahu. So you know, you see a statue and you're like, wow, and then you see another one and another one, and then there's hundreds of them. It literally boggles the mind. It's the kind of thing that you have to see. You really do have to experience in person to get a grasp of what that's like. One of the things that I realize is how biased we are about our own Western beliefs about what it takes to do things. You know, here's an island that's only 160 square kilometers or so. That's centered thousands of miles from anywhere else, any other larger body of land, very limited resources, and what looks like a very reasonably small population, a population that looks like between 3,000 and 4,000 at contact, which may have been the stable maximum population size. Here's a population with very limited resources, but able to achieve just incredible things. And it's through the ingenuity of Rapa Nui people that make that happen. And when you go there, you realize, you know, that a lot of your expectations about what it takes to do something are just wrong. Like, we assume it takes massive leaders and technology and energy, and we've got to invest all this stuff in order to make this happen. They did it within the context of the island. So it's really sort of an eye-opening experience about what humans can achieve, and sort of appreciation for the fact that people in the past were just as smart as us. You know, we often believe that because we're here now, that we're so much smarter than the people in the past because, oh, they're gone. No, of course not. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they had a really good understanding of how to do things. And you really get appreciation for that. So that was a kind of one of the eye-opening aspects of being on the island. In terms of moving the statue, we made the statue ex an exact duplicate, although scaled, of a road moai, a statue that was found in between the Ahu and the platform. To a sort of millimeter level precision, because we knew that if we were going to make this work, it had to match exactly a statue that they were moving themselves. It couldn't be an approximation of a statue, it couldn't be an average statue, and it needed to be a statue in the transport position, because that's the form that it needs to take in order to transport it. It was 4.35 tons or something like that, which is you know, small from a overall moai perspective, but incredibly heavy. You know, you could push on it and it isn't going to move at all. There's no way to fake it. You know, it wasn't going anywhere. And we tried, if you see the video, to see the Nova special, we systematically tried a variety of things, and it seems like we were sort of chaotically trying it, but we were trying to start from the perspective of what's the least number of ropes and things that we might need in order to get it working. Because you can always add, you know, 50 ropes and stuff, and if you get it moving with that, you don't really know, like, well, what is it? What's the least amount of stuff it took? So we were scaling up from, like, what's the least thing we can try, and then moving up systematically. But as we were doing that, it didn't move at all. Like, it wasn't going anywhere. And we were, you know, yanking on it and trying to get it to go. Doing archaeology in front of TV is always an interesting experience, because you're driven by TV's needs, not about archaeology needs, about the science needs. The TV people are like, well, you've got this amount of time, and we're going to bug you every 5 minutes to ask you questions so you don't get anything done. So, you know, and of course, we're just slowing us down. So it was the second day, a half hour before, a crane was there to pick up the statue and move it to where it was going to sit. This was done in Hawaii, in the valley where they filmed Lost and Jurassic Park and all kind of anything that's Polynesian is filmed there. So it was in this wild landscape. And they were going to move it there. And you can still see it, actually, that statue there today at Kualoa Ranch. We were at the point where it's like, well, you know, they're asking us, well, it doesn't seem like you were successful, and, you know, have you learned anything? And we were like, yeah, well, everything's a learning experience, and, you know, we'll blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we started tweaking different things, and suddenly it came to life. And it was really getting the combinations of forces on the sides, tying it in the right spot with one rope in the back, so a three rope combination. And suddenly it's like we put the key into the ignition, turned the key, and suddenly the thing took off. And it really didn't take that much force to make it happen. Once we got it rocking, because of the forward lean and because of the rounded base that's in the front, the statue kind of rolls forward and takes a step each time it rocks from side to side. Very much like walking, our own walking ability. So it really went from something, the immovable object, to something that was literally dancing down the road. I mean, it was incredible. It was so I was sort of skeptical about the whole thing all along. It's, it's just gonna fall over and break, and then we're gonna look bad, and it's gonna be on TV. But it went from an incredible success, and it was really, not our ingenuity. It was the Rapa Nui ingenuity that carved it in such a way that when you got the parts right, it was gonna move. And we just happened to get into that. And that's what really convinced me that we'd really nailed it, because that wasn't by accident alone. That wasn't just happening to tie it and getting stuff to move. It was really just dialed in. And then the physics all worked amazingly well. So it was a really an amazing, rewarding experience to see that.
So something I found really interesting is that these road moai, the walking method, and I was curious if, as a result, it would kind of create these sort of roads, right? Because it's going to like cause the ground to kind of go deeper. But I was wondering if there were like pre-prepared roads, or the walking method just kind of created these transport roads for the Rapa Nui people.
Well, it looks like they're making them in advance. Interesting. The construction of the road it looks like, at least from what I've seen, the roads are constructed as part of the walking of the statues themselves. Each statue gets a road on its own, and they're being constructed in advance of that particular statue. Because we actually see roads on top of roads. So excavations that have been done show that roads are crisscrossing each other, and they're being constructed specifically for that statue. So it's part of the tradition of moving it was actually preparing that surface. The roads themselves often have curb stones on the sides, so you actually see stones embedded in the ground that are like curbs on each side. They're about the same. They're about con pretty consistent width, but they're definitely constructed in advance. The statues themselves probably, had an impact on the soil themselves, but I suspect what we find, in fact, the cross sections of the roads are concave, so they're lower in the middle than they are on the side. That's probably not from walking the statues, but they're probably building them that way to help the transport. And there's two hypotheses we have about that. One is the concave roadbeds are guiding the statues, because one of the things as we started to move this, 5-ton statue, once it's moving, it's going. So it helps guide it in the direction you want it to go. The other possibility is that one of the challenges that you have of the stone is that when you rock it to the side, the entire force, the entire weight of the statue is on the outside edge of the statue. So you've got this, in our case, 5-ton, but say 30 or 50-ton statue all on the very edge of the statue as it's rocked to its side, which causes a basal fracture to occur. In fact, many of the road statues has large fracturing on the bottom side of the statue, from a force that's going up from the ground into the statue itself, which again is a strong clue that these things were being moved standing up and rocking on that side. The curved roads probably eases that fracturing, mitigates that by softening the edge that it gets on. Because that we saw that consistently enough that it's probably one of the reasons why statues didn't make it from the quarry to the platforms, because they fracture in that way. And once they fall over and you can't pick them back up again. So the roads are probably constructed to facilitate those moving. Certainly it flattens the ground too, I should say.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. I've been speaking with Carl Lippo, a professor of anthropology at Binghamton University, about the Moai statues on Easter Island and how they were transported, to learn more.
So you looked at this specific transportation method of, walking the Moai statues. But are there other transportation methods that they had, the Rapa Nui? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, some people sort of criticize us and say, like, well, no, I don't think so. There are probably many ways that people move statues, blah, blah, blah. Of course, no one's ever demonstrated that there's evidence for any other way. I should say people can show there's a lot of plausible ways you could do it. So you could take a bunch of trees and make some rollers, and you can slide it along things with bananas and, sweet potato grease, lots of ways that you could do it. The question is there evidence that they did it this way? Like, where's the archaeological evidence? So from the archaeological evidence, no, we don't have other evidence that suggests that they were moved in different ways. There are just arguments to say that they could have moved it in other ways. The challenge is that when we look at the statues, the largest statues, we see evidence this car the shape of them, like the bases and the angles and stuff, can't be explained by any other alternative techniques. There's no reason if you're going to roll it on rollers or on a sled, why you would make it lean forward so it would tip over, right? Those things can't be explained by these alternatives. So while it's possible, there's all kinds of, people could have stitched together fish skin hot air balloons and lifted them across the island, but there's really no evidence whatsoever that any of these alternatives occurred. People talk about like, well, maybe they were moved on rafts. Like, well, okay, let's see the evidence of rafts. Let's see that rafts float enough to be able to put a 20, 30 ton statue on top of. Lots of claims have been made, but no evidence has been documented. So in our experience, when you look at the features of the statues themselves, as the statues get larger and larger, their similarities get greater and greater. The shapes of them matter more and more because that particular mode of transportation, standing in an upright position with a rounded base in the front, leaning forward, that becomes more and more critical because upright is the only way you can move it, right? So if people were moving things in different ways, we would see various forms of statues that would take different varieties. But we don't see that. We actually see very, very consistency. If they're moving them in other ways, the smallest ones, yeah, you probably could get a bunch of people to pick up a 2-ton statue and move it around. I mean, certainly the smaller ones, yeah, there's no limits to that. But once they get larger, it looks like really there's a convergence on this particular form.
So you have talked about how this transportation style, it makes sense because they are kind of leaning forward. If it was any other way, how would that work?
Why would you do that? Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, are some of them carved in a different way, or were they all carved in that way where they were sort of leaning forward? Like, did it enable or even hinder some forms of transportation? Obviously, if they're leaning forward, it would hinder other ways of transportation other than the walking. But were there other ways that they were carved?
Well, I mean, all the statues that are in the transport. So there's statues at the quarry, right, they're in the rock and being prepared for movement. So there, you'll see those, the heads of Easter Island, as people talk about it, are actually full statues that are in trenches that are standing and being prepared for transportation. They're abandoned for, we don't know exactly why. It may be because, the Europeans arrived. It could be because they decided to not finish it. But anyways, dirt erosion fills in the trench around them, and that's what we see, just the head, the head part, but it is a full statue. But once you go past the quarry and you look at all the statues that are between there and the Ahu, they all have this incredible forward lean, very absolutely consistently. One of the things we know about their transport statues is they're not finished until the eyes are carved into them. Up until that point, the eyes are basically just a slot where the eyes would be. They're just an indentation. Once they get to the quarry, once they get to the Ahu and they're stood up and they're recarved because they have to reshape them in order to stand upright because they wouldn't stand up otherwise, the bases are reshaped. And we can actually see the evidence of that. Once they're standing there, their actually eyes are carved into them. And then inserted into the holes are coral and obsidian and red scoria eyeballs. Those are the eyes that just turn on the ancestors that then look at the community. It's really clear. When I first got there, I was saying, well, yeah, maybe some of these do that. No, absolutely every single one. Because that's the point. Once you get them to the Sahu, you're turning them on, and then the ancestors are alive and doing their job. Up until that point, they're sleeping. So when you look at all the statues before they have their eyes carved into them, which is the transport statues, they all have this forward lean. They have a wider base than the ones at the statues. They're not able to stand up. They're very, very different. So yeah, you could take one of those statues that's weird, in terms of leaning forward, and you could put it on rollers, but why would you carve it in such a way that it for that? Because you still have to change it back into the statue. So it doesn't, again, there's no real particular evidence of that other thing, and it sort of doesn't explain why you would get that. The other thing is like the roller hypothesis and some of the sliding doesn't explain why the roads are concave. Like if you have rollers, right, the rollers are going to be across the road. And there'd be the big gap between at the bottom that doesn't make any, like you would make the roads in order to facilitate these other things. And you don't see that at all. You really see something that's shaped for the walking. So again, all the lines of evidence really point to this is the way they do it. We always challenge other people who are saying like, no, you're wrong. Say, well, okay, maybe, right? We're open to the fact we could be wrong because, Rapa Nui people were really creative and probably had lots of ideas about how you could move it. But let's see some evidence that points to the fact, something we can't explain. And it's possible. I mean, there's no reason why people couldn't have tried other ways, but let's see it. We just want to see the archaeological evidence.
So, for you, what did you find most fascinating about this research?
Well, again, when we first started working there, this is now 25 years ago, so a long time, a generation ago. We went there with the idea that this is a small island, it's very famous. It purportedly had been well documented in terms of the archaeological record. And we went there to try to figure out how the story went from, people arriving on this island, doing what people do and turning into the story that we often hear about, that there was this crazy place that people did this nutty thing and it caused ecological destruction. And, certainly it seemed plausible. I mean, there was so much fame and, the story was so popular. It seemed like, well, that's possible. So we wanted to study like early on. Like people obviously didn't go there to like, let's destroy this place. They went there doing what, big, all good intentions. But as we started to study the island, we started to realize that a lot of the things that people assume must be there just weren't there. The evidence of ecological destruction, this large populations, all these things just weren't possible. And then as we started doing, sort of trying to unravel, like what's going on here? Why are people doing this? It's become clear that the statues, the reason why people make these gigantic statues isn't because they were making nutty, crazy things. It's because it mattered a lot to them. And these were important dimensions of their culture, which actually had benefits to them and to survive on this remote, tiny island in the middle of the Pacific. That the act of doing it required cooperation. It required people to work together in such a way that actually made them more resilient on this island, where there really were very few or no options if you didn't have the resources to survive. There isn't just another island you can jump onto to get resources, food. If in fact you run out of food on the island, you've got to figure it out how to survive there with the resources you've got. And we've realized, now looking at all the other parts of the community and what they're doing and all the starts, that statue construction is really the secret to survival on this island. Very counterintuitive, but in fact, it makes perfect sense when you understand sort of the economics of the island and the constraints there and what it takes to survive there. To me, that's the most exciting thing. It's like this thing that was we see as weird and bizarre and like, why would anyone do that? And is it aliens? Turns out to be this incredibly cool solution to a problem that we face ourselves. Like, how do we survive as a communities in a place with limited resources or diminishing resources? I think there's a lot to learn from there. To me, that's really exciting because archaeology is often treated as like, oh, it's some stories about the past that are interesting but not useful. I think there's actually really useful information from there that we can derive from studying these people. I think, their success is just something extraordinary that we really need to learn from.
That was Carl Lippow, a professor of anthropology at Binghamton University. His research was originally published in the Journal of Archaeological Science. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1835. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Madeline Reynolds.